All right, we will waive water and connection fees when you, you know, you build out to the curb and we have our line coming in, and we'll waive those fees if you're gonna do a development. Great, wonderful. Habitat's eligible for that just like anybody else. Habitat recently initiated a new build and paid connection fees in order to meet a self-imposed deadline. In other words, they were going to have to come to the Physical Development Committee. They were going to have to get approval from staff. They didn't want to wait that long. They just wanted to do it. So they just, bam, built this thing without ever requesting the waiver of those connection fees. The organization now realizes that if it uses charitable contributions to cover the $3,100 worth of fees, it will have to account for that value in the cost basis of the home, pass the cost on to the homeowner. In other words, the way Habitat works is they actually have to have a real valuation of the house, and they set up a mortgage for the low-income person to be able to buy into that house. Now, they build the houses as inexpensively as possible, and they have special, you know, they might give a low interest rate, so on and so forth, but by law, they need to say, this house is worth X, and so we're selling it to this party for X. They realize now that by paying for those fees, the value of the house is $3,100 higher than it might otherwise be by accounting principles. So that would result in an increase in the mortgage costs of $15 a month to a potential home buyer. Now, $15, big deal, right? But if you are low income, stretching to get into your first house, that actually can matter, okay? So they want to avoid that cost. In order to avoid this extra cost for the home buyer, Habitat has now requested a refund of the fees, which it will not enter into its books as a charitable contribution. The city attorney indicates that a refund, which is not contemplated in the city code, must be considered a gift to the nonprofit and requires a supermajority of council for approval. Should council approve this request? Now, let me make sure you understand exactly what happened in this conversation, because it was amazing. Habitat for Humanity comes in and says, we wish we had asked for the waiver, but we didn't. They could have, but they chose not to. Now we realize that we wish we had. There's nothing in the city code that allows for a retroactive waiver. Council could vote to give you $3,100, although according to our rules of procedure, gifts to nonprofits require a supermajority, okay? Because it's not just a typical expenditure, it's actually a gift of public money into private hands, so to speak. So it requires a supermajority. We could vote to give you a charitable contribution of $3,100. On camera, in public, Habitat says, you give us a charitable contribution, but we won't put it on our books as a charitable contribution. We'll put it on our books as a refund of the fees. Should I vote for this or not? I'm going to give them the money, and in effect, they're going to commit tax fraud. On camera, in public, they said, no, it won't work as a charitable contribution for us. We need to actually show it as a refund so that the value of the house goes down. And we said, well, we can't give you a refund. There's nothing in the code that allows that. Okay, just give us the money. We'll just log it as a refund. But it's not a refund. We need a supermajority. I'm on council.
No.
We have seven. Okay. Three say no. Three say, come on, Mike. Like your neighbors, your friends, your buddies are like on the board of Habitat. And it's a great organization. They do good work. Just vote with us. And you're not committing fraud. They are.
That's good old boy stuff.
That's...
All right, so what should we do? So you say you love Habitat. I mean, I've banged nails on Habitat houses, right? So you love them. You work with them. Your friends are on the board. But the answer is
no.
No. The answer is no. The answer is no.
Probably not.
Oh, probably. Ooh, I want to hear why. I mean, they were like, no. But you're probably. Why are you slightly edging?
I was just joking.
Okay.
No.
I mean, but you can feel the tension.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Jared.
I would lean towards no, but at the same time, what they if as council we were within our best practices, what they do after that is on them. But I get the appearance of it.
Well, no, that's you want to talk about communicating facts. I mean, the fact is that we will log it on our books as a charitable contribution, knowing that they will log it on their books as a refund.
It's dishonest.
You know, I think if they wouldn't have said it,
exactly,
we'd have been good together. But the fact that they said it on TV, you know, on the public forum, this is what we're going to do here.
So it would have been better if it were a smoke-filled room, right? Like, if Habitat came to the back room and said, hey, this is what we want to do.
They just never would have said it.
So they were stupid just to even voice
if they never would have said it.
If we didn't know it.
If we didn't know it, they never said it.
If they hadn't said it, you wouldn't know it.
Yeah.
Good. All right. So one possible answer to this case is absolutely not. This is us basically aiding and abetting fraud, and we can't do it. If we didn't know what they were going to do, then we wouldn't be aiding and abetting. I mean, we would unknowingly contributed to their ability to commit fraud, but we wouldn't have been implicated in making that decision. So if they had just come to us and said, you know, we built this house and we realized we could have asked for the waiver, but we had a self-imposed deadline. We just wanted to get this build done, so we didn't ask for it. Well, question number one, if they say, can we get a refund now, should we give them a refund? I mean, council can do whatever it wants.
I'm just speaking to me. I would be more likely to give them the refund now because of the organization. You know, because I know they live on donations.
Right.
If they put it to me that way. Not if they came in and said,
so the city attorney says, look, we have the waiver built into the code. What we don't have is a refund system.
Right.
They come now and they say, we screwed up. They admit, it was on us, it wasn't on you. It's not like your staff slowed us down and that's why we couldn't get it done. We could have done it, we didn't. We realized the error in our ways. Could you please give us a refund? Now, there's nothing in the code that talks about refunds.
We'll give you the money back.
So you would not give a refund?
Right,
because no, it's not in our code.
It's not in the code. You can't
change the code.
No, I don't think I want to be. If they made a mistake, let it be a learning lesson for them. Because once we go down this road, we have to do it continuously forever, maybe. So let's set a standard. You made a mistake, that's on you. This time, we're giving you the rules and regulations, what you have to do, abide by.
Beautiful, beautiful. So maybe the two of you could be getting together on this. The answer would be, the code does not allow a refund. We as council can change city code. I mean, we could do that tonight, right? We'll just vote on it and we'll do it. Or we could, Sarah's gonna freak out that I say this, but I've been advised many times, both by the city manager and by the city attorney, we can effectively do whatever we want. In other words, we can just break the law. We can just vote to give a refund even though the code doesn't allow it, because who's gonna sue us over that? Habitat's not gonna sue us over that. So, yeah, it's in the code, but council's will is council's will. Now, I am not recommending that, but if you want to talk about legal exposure, who's going to sue you over this? Well, actually, Andre, you have an answer, right? Because you've said one of the reasons I don't want to do this is because it does set a precedent. So now all the other developers who, for whatever the reason, didn't ask for their waivers are going to come to the city and say, hey, You gave a refund to them. What? Why not me? I also want the refund. And then another developer is going to come and say, well, 50 years ago I built that development before you ever had this waiver thing. Now you have the waiver thing and you're obviously giving refunds. I want a retroactive action on council to give me the money that I spent 50 years ago on all the water hookups. And Andre's saying, you got to be kidding me. This is going to completely open the floodgates. Cannot do it. What you're asking for is consistency in how you treat all of the people that might be hooking up to our sewer and water. Okay? Consistency matters to you. You're going to do it for them, you're going to have to do it for everyone. If you're not going to do it for everyone, you should not do it for them. Beautiful. Then Dwayne comes in and says, I agree with Andre. We cannot do this piecemeal. We can't give them a refund. I don't want to change city code because it's going to open the floodgates. We like the code the way it is. So we have to tell them, I'm sorry, you can't have a refund. But I'll give them a contribution. I'll give them $3,100. Now, I wish they hadn't said anything about how they're going to log it on their books. But they need $3,100. You said it because of who they are. It's a good organization. Give them $3,100. Agree or disagree?
I disagree.
All right, well, I want to hear Jared first, and then I'll come to you. Go ahead.
I disagree.
Why?
So, to go back all the way to the start, what is the purpose of the waiver? Can that part of it, to fix things in the future, could that part be taken out? It's just either have everybody pay it or nobody pay it. Like, I feel that was step one of the issue.
Well, actually, you have a couple of options there. One version could be do away with this problem. In other words, change the code so that people can get refunds, and then everybody can get it. Or don't change the code, in which case nobody can get a refund. There's a third possibility, which is you could change the code to say certain eligible nonprofits can get refunds, whereas nobody else gets refunds. I mean, you could write that into the code. Do you want to do that?
No.
No. Why not?
You're giving special status to one group.
Beautiful. So this would be an example of preferential treatment.
Right.
You're treating this one group one way because you're buddies with the chair of the board, but other nonprofits, I mean, you're tailoring the law to a very specific entity. We should never write laws with names in them, right? You have to have a system in place that you then plug all the names into over time, right? So you don't write laws for a particular incumbent. So your position is going to be, we need to be fair, we need to be consistent. That means we cannot give a refund, and we don't even want to contemplate changing the law to allow the refund, because if we do that, it's a slippery slope, and everybody's going to ask for a refund. So the answer is, nobody gets a refund. That's the answer to the question that Jared posed. The answer is going to be, we don't do refunds. We're not going to change that law. Then Dwayne says, since we've all agreed now that we're not going to do refunds, let's give them a charitable contribution. Agree or disagree? Give them a charitable contribution. Agree or disagree?
Disagree.
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 Uh-oh, we got 3-2. This is scary. Make me an argument. Why do you agree? And then one of the three of you, why do you disagree? So why would you agree to that?
A charitable gift, totally separate from this. If it happens to be tied in, if we did it 2 months later, what difference would it make?
Beautiful, beautiful. So council has the authority to give monies to local nonprofits. This is a good one. Now, I'm not sure what your rules of procedure say, but in Lynchburg, our rules of procedure said any charitable gift needs to have a supermajority of council. So I just want you to know that right now, 3-2, this would fail. Okay, so you're gonna have to muster up one more vote in
where,
favor.
Where did you get 3-2?
Well, he counted me.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't vote unless it's a tie.
Let's.
But today I vote.
Today you vote. We're missing one.
Well, I knew that's what you're doing. Today I vote.
You are right. This is
right.
Theoretically, where do you stand? Right. Okay. You disagree. Right. Don't give charitable contribution.
Right.
Why?
You know, basing off the way we do things in town, we at budget time we have a procedure where nonprofits can come in and say, could we have this much this year for this?
Beautiful.
Okay. But during the year, if you didn't make that request, we're not likely to give you a donation.
Excellent. So your point, perfectly consistent with your previous point, is no preferential treatment. So if Habitat is deserving of an uptick in whatever donation the city might have given them, I don't know if you have ever funded it or not, that should be handled through the normal, typical budgeting process.
Absolutely.
So there's going to be a time of year when you get to make your request. There's going to be a council work session where we look at all the requests. My guess is your philosophy is something like, we give money to nonprofits when we believe that by partnering with that group, we can achieve a legitimate town interest probably more efficiently than if we did it ourselves. So you would agree to partner with a nonprofit because they fix a problem that you want fixed. You're not just giving to your favorite charities.
Right?
It has to be a town interest. So your argument would be, if Habitat is worthy, they need to be vetted the same way any other nonprofit is vetted, which is they have to submit a request at the appropriate time in the budget cycle, and they will be approved at an appropriate time in the budget cycle, which means Dwayne is still engaged in preferential treatment to Habitat because he's willing to give the money outside of the normal process.
Well, I'll tell you, I agree with the yeses there, because that's true. But I was looking at it from your Lynchburg point of view, not from the town.
No. Lynchburg is just like you. For nonprofits, there is a process. Like, we gave money to CASA. We gave money to Legal Aid. There were a handful of nonprofits that did work that we felt benefited the city, and that if we partnered with them, if we gave them some money, they could achieve those goals in a way that we as government did not want to get involved. I don't want to open a new department of whatever. So we coordinated. We gave money because we believed they were doing those things that we wanted to have done. But it's still required. You put in your request by such and such a date. These are the forms you use. During the budget cycle, we will have a work session where, after we're done with all of the other big items, we'll look at the small amount of money that we set aside, and we'll divvy it up.
Well, I agree with that. Then I'm out on this.
Then you're out.
I'm out because it's violation of our policies.
So it leaves Mike standing alone.
I'm generally on the bad side of the 3-2 votes. I'm generally on the losing side.
So you're happy to lose that vote, but you would still say, just give them the $3,100. It's $3,100. It doesn't mean anything to us, and it's really important to them. Just give it to them. Andre?
We, as a council, we have our standards and our boundaries that we have to stay within. And we can't go out of that just for a special group, because then we begin to be unfair to others. And we don't want to, I can't say, we have a standard that come in to get this money, but we don't want to start giving out money as a reward for your sloppiness, for your negligence, and your lack of business skills. We don't want to reward you for that. We want to give our money to what people have done correctly, came to us correctly. They requested this. Within the time limit they're supposed to, and they're going to be an asset to our town, and they've done it the proper way. There is a proper way to do things, to get things from the town.
There absolutely is. There's also, if you will, justice can be tempered by mercy. If someone comes and says, I screwed up, and this really is important, then it is entirely possible that council could take pity on that entity and say, go ahead and do it. So I'm not sure that you would never depart from normal operating procedures. But if you're going to depart from normal operating procedures, you have to have a really good reason for it. You have to be able to show, if you're going to do something exceptional, there has to be an exceptional justification for it. So you have to tell a really special story. And I think your point would be the fact that you knew you could have applied for this and actually chose not to because of some self-imposed deadline, that does not rise to some extraordinary circumstance that you couldn't see coming, that you need relief. There's another way to say what you just said, which I used to say all the time when I was on council, which is, don't assume that you can make your problem my problem. You got a problem? That could be your problem. It's not necessarily my problem. So if you decided to rush the build, that was a choice you made. I didn't choose to rush, so I'm not going to do it. But the key thing here, the key point, and Mike is our lone dissenter at this point, the key point here is we don't want to engage in preferential treatment. We recognize that our duty is to the town, not to our friends, even if our friends work in very productive ways that we love. That we need to be consistent in how we apply the rules. Which ultimately would mean, I can't give you a you already told me you're gonna fraudulently put this on your books. I can't participate in that. So I'm not giving you a refund. I'm not gonna change the code in order to give you a refund. Sorry, you have to go through normal procedures. Then the question of charity comes up, and the answer again is going to be, I love you. I think you're a great organization. I want to give you $3,100. But you need to make that request in December, and we'll debate it in March, and it'll be in the budget in May. So come back to me next year, I'll give you $3,100.
Absolutely.
Comments, questions, arguments, because we're going to see where this takes us. By the way, this is a true story.
Yeah, what was the vote?
They needed my vote to make the supermajority.
They didn't get it.
They did not get it. But I think Habitat's a great organization.
Yeah.
And I was friends with people who were on the board. And as I said, I pounded nails on a Habitat app more than once. But I did not give them the vote. And so even if they could get a bare majority, it failed. So they didn't get it. And they were probably pretty pissed at me when it was over.
It's part of the game.
Sarah, do you want to comment at all on this example?
I want to know what staff recommended.
You know, that's really interesting. Because I don't know if you knew Walter Irwin as a city attorney, but he was like the crackerjack.
He is.
City attorney.
Well regarded around the entire state. Yes, absolutely. And of course, Kim is. Was Kim manager then?
Kim was manager.
Okay, yeah, so I'm really curious to hear what Walter and Kim had to say.
They did not recommend that we do it. They did not block the request from coming to council because Habitat, I mean, we had a public comment area. Habitat asked to be on the agenda. We put them on the agenda. But Walter, the city attorney, did say, technically you cannot give them a refund. It's not in the city code. You could change the city code. And he even said, I'm just your attorney. You could do it anyway. It will be a violation of the city code. And I cannot predict the repercussions of that. Now you as counsel, you need to decide, is that a move you want to make? And my answer was, that is not a move I want to make. In fact, no one on council wanted, this is what was interesting, no one on council wanted to break the city code. Okay? So that was unanimous. No one was saying, give them a refund even though the code doesn't allow it. Nobody said that. And staff actually recommended, you can do it, it's not a smart move. The debate then was charitable contribution, charitable contribution now versus put it into the regular queue. When we got into that debate, staff was a little less directive. And they basically said, there's nothing in the code that says you can't give a charitable gift anytime you want during the year. So if you guys want to do it, you can do it. If you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. And I didn't give them the vote they needed. Staff in Lynchburg, and I'm hearing that you really like your staff here. Staff in Lynchburg was very good about giving us all the information we needed to be able to make decisions. And if we asked for recommendations, they certainly would make recommendations about why certain things go the way they do. But staff never told us what we had to do. Walter never told us what we had to do. Walter would go into the back room during closed session and say, you got three options. Here are the risks and benefits associated with your three options. Now you guys got to decide. What do we learn from this? Anybody else want to comment on this one? As a as staff members? What do you think about this? No comment?
I would think if they gave the contribution, they'd be going against what they had said with the what they said they were gonna, how they were gonna report it. I'd have an issue with that if
you
I was on council. Yeah, absolutely.
Now you're clerk.
I am the clerk, yes. And
so,
usually I don't talk.
Well, I know, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But it's your responsibility actually to put in the minutes
right.
what happened. So you would have had to have actually recorded all of this detail about how they are going to put this on their books one way and we're going to put it on our books another way.
Right.
So you'd be responsible. And then if a council member came back, you'd say, oh, I don't like the way you put that in the minutes.
Well, you want to listen to it again.
You know, I was going to bring up another case. I don't even think I have it in here. Another case that I had while I was on council had to do with the clerk, where a quote was in the minutes, or at least an implication. You know, a statement was in the minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Council member came back later and said, please take that out. Clerk said, listen to the tape, that's what it is. Council member said, I know, that might be what I said, but it's not what I meant. And actually, he didn't even say that. What he said was, it looks worse on paper. And so I really just don't want it put into the minutes. And it was something like, well, I would give money to this group because, you know, they've done great stuff in our community before. This other group, I don't know them. I don't trust them. So then in the minutes is, well, I don't trust this developer. And then he says, it just looks bad on paper. So could you strike it for me, please? And it would be interesting to hear what your position would be as a clerk.
Well, for one thing, our minutes don't reflect statements like that.
They're not transcripts.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So
the recording's posted. Anybody
right.
wants to listen to the recording,
they can hear it.
Yeah. Somebody and we have people that have gone back and listened or watched the videos on YouTube since they've been YouTubed.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you do that. The most important time of my career as a politician when that happened was the paper quoted me. And the quote was, if I was gonna do that, blah, blah, blah. I don't remember what the issue was. And the reporter called and said, so we're getting ready to go to press. You good with the story? And I said, well, I would never talk that way. She said, what do you mean? That's what you said. I said, no. If I were, it's in the subjunctive. Grammar matters to me. I would never say, if I was going to do this. I would have said, if I were going to do that. She said, no, you said what? I said, look, if that's what you heard, I'm not going to get in a fight over it. But that's just not the way I talk. So they went to the tape. I got a phone call back from the reporter saying, you said were, not was. So I was very happy.
Yeah.
So grammar matters. There you go. Now you know something about me. All right. Let me tell you what we do with this case and why it matters. And this is going to set us up for our next phase of discussion, which I think for the afternoon we are going to spend time working on revising sort of rules of engagement for counsel. But I want to teach you this new word. Some of you, well, probably none of you have ever seen this word. It is a technical term in philosophical jargon, supererogation. An act is supererogatory, or an act of supererogation, if it is above and beyond the call of duty, which I think you all pretty much understand what that means, right? So in order for something to be above and beyond the call of the duty, two things have to be true about that action. Number one, it cannot be prohibited, so it's not an action you're not allowed to do. It also cannot be obligatory. It's not an action that you're required to do. It lands in between. It's permissible, but it's not obligatory. So it's discretionary. If you want to do it, you can do it. If you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. So requirement number one for something to be supererogatory, above and beyond the call of duty, is it's a voluntary choice you get to make. Second, it has to be desirable. When you do it, yay, we're very, very happy, right? But remember, it's not obligatory, which means if you don't do it, we don't penalize you. We reward you if you do it. We don't punish you if you fail to do it, okay? So this is the notion of supererogation. Now, you might ask yourself, is there anything in the world that's supererogatory? And of course, the answer is yes, you know that. We can come up with a gazillion examples. quick one. We're all in our foxhole, okay? And we're all looking out from our foxhole, and all of a sudden through the air flies a grenade, and it lands in the foxhole, and I see it, and I yell, "Grenade!" And everybody jumps out of the foxhole except for me. I jump on the grenade. Boom! It blows up. I get killed or seriously injured. Hopefully not killed. What happens? I get a medal. Mike's a hero. Tell the story a second time. We're all in our foxhole. We all have our rifles. We're all looking out from the foxhole. Grenade comes through the air. I see it. It lands in the foxhole. And I say, "Grenade!" And everybody jumps out of the foxhole, including me. Boom! The grenade goes off. Some of us don't get out in time and get seriously injured. Should I get court-martialed? I think the answer is no, right? Okay, so I'm not punished for failing to jump on the grenade, but I get a medal if I do jump on the grenade. What is that? That's an example of supererogation. You went above and beyond the call of duty. Duty is going to be an important word here. So what we have to recognize, what's important about this, is that there is a huge difference. Listen carefully. There is a huge difference between being nice and being ethical. Do not think for a second that you will be an ethical person simply because you do nice things. It would have been nice to give the money to Habitat. I also could argue it would have been inconsistent with my role as a council member to do it. We need to distinguish between just making people happy and being swell versus actually satisfying our ethical obligations. Okay, this is a huge distinction. Difference between being nice and being ethical. So if there's a difference between being nice and being ethical, and if your responsibilities, your ethical responsibilities, do not just derive from what would be swell, what would be sweet, right? We have to ask ourselves, where do those obligations come from? What is the source of ethical duty, which is different than just being nice? Well, we need to identify our background obligations. And I would argue that there are two sources that you need to think about when you think about your ethical obligations as council members. One, what is your role? And roles involve expectations for behavior that might never have been written down on paper. It's not necessarily a contract. Okay? When I became a father, I assumed a responsibility to feed my kid. I never signed a daddy contract. No, nobody said when I was bringing the kid home from the hospital, "By the way, Mike, you're going to have to feed this thing." So if I now bring it home and leave it there, and then my child starves to death, the police come knocking on my door, do I get to say, I never agreed to feed it? No, built into being a parent is that you take care of your kid. Another example, I'm doing a retreat in Amherst today, driving all the way from Lynchburg, okay? While I'm here, I have an affair. Lunchtime, because we don't have a lot of time together, but there's someone here, ooh, this is hot, right? Lunchtime, have an affair. Go back home at night, there's lipstick on my collar. My wife says, "Mike, did you screw around with someone else?" And I say, "Yes. But go look at the videotape of our wedding vows." Never once did I say, "I will forsake all others." It wasn't in the vows. And actually, you can go, I've been married long enough, it actually is a videotape, and you can go look, and guess what? I never said it. Do I say to my wife, "I never agreed to that"? And do you think my wife's going to say, "Oh, Mike, you got me on the technicality"? I mean, we never wrote it down, so I guess I couldn't write. No, that is not what's going to happen, right? It is. It's going to be a shitstorm, and I'm going to deserve whatever comes at me. I'm going to become the crap catcher that day, and probably for the rest of my life. Because why? Because even though we didn't explicitly, like, make an oath on this, built into the role of being a husband is a reasonable expectation for monogamy, for fidelity. Now, that might not be true for everybody's marriage. You might be in an open marriage where you decide you can have sex with anybody you want.
Yeah, right.
But you know, well, I know at least one person who claims, I think they call this polyamorous now, that we're going to be in an open relationship. You know what? If you set that up as the nature of your relationship, I mean, I'm with you. I don't think it's going to work. I think there's going to be stress that it generates somewhere down the line. But if that's what you guys agreed to, who am I to tell you not to do it? I mean, go for it. I don't care. But I can tell you right now, my wife's not going to buy it. Okay? Because it's built into my role. It didn't have to be written down. One of the things we need to be thinking about today, we're going to try to write a bunch of stuff down, but you're going to have to recognize that by virtue of the fact that you are a council member, there are expectations for your behavior that could never be written down. One of them might be, well, maybe we will write this down. You shouldn't badmouth the town. You shouldn't disparage staff or your fellow colleagues, right? You have hard decisions to make, but to some degree, built into your role is being an Amherst cheerleader. Every one of you said that you grew up around here, that you love this place, right? You all, many of you said you want to like serve the community. All right, built into your role is a question of service. I don't know how to write that down. We'll play with it and see if we can. The second source of your obligation, relationships. If you make promises, then you have to keep them. Consistency matters. Okay? Which, some of you are wondering about whether or not we have good relationships, say, with our local businesses or businesses we're trying to recruit. But if you make a commitment, then you have an ethical obligation to satisfy that commitment, which means we need to be very careful about the commitments we make. Because if we promise something to one party, immediately we're going to have to be able to answer, why does this person get it but that person doesn't? And if there's no significant difference in the nature of our relationships, then I'll be treating people unfairly when I apply one standard to one person and a different standard to someone else. So, what you need to do, what we all need to do every day, is we need to recognize that the role we play can generate a series of tacit expectations. They don't always have to be written down, but we need to be alert so that when we behave, we are behaving consistently with the reasonable expectations that our fellow council members, our staff, and our citizens have of us. And then we also need to make sure that we are very clear about explicit promises that we have made. What have we actually said we're going to do, and are we doing it? If we're not doing it, we need to either explain why we changed our minds, or we need to get on the stick. So when we think about ethics in local government, we have to recognize, look, ethics is not a question of being nice. Ethics is a question of, what are my obligations? So step number one is going to be to identify the obligations that by default just attach to me by looking at our roles and looking at our relationships. I also need to recognize that there are distinct obligations across individuals, disciplines, departments. If you have one constituency and you have another constituency, you might feel loyalty to a group that you don't. Well, one of the biggest mistakes we make is to condemn in someone else something that we would forgive in ourselves. So if you're busy talking up to your crowd, you can hardly get pissed off if he's busy talking up to his crowd.
Right.
Right? So we need to understand exactly what the obligations are and recognize that people in different circumstances will have different obligations. Staff has a different obligation than an elected official. Sometimes these things will conflict. And we're going to need to prioritize those obligations when they conflict. Notice what I did with the Habitat vote. Did I have relationships that would have made voting yes for that very easy and happy and nice? Sure did. But I had an overriding obligation because of my role on council not to subvert the public body's work by advancing my own personal agenda. And if the conflicting obligations are properly prioritized, you're a team player. you got to support that ballot process. Even if the vote's 3-2, when we're done with the vote, you have to say, I made my argument, I lost the vote, on to the next issue. If you think something's not working right, right, then you get to cry foul. In fact, you have to become a whistleblower. You have to, I mean, it becomes your job then to say, hey, wait a minute, there's something dirty going on here. But if there's nothing dirty going on there, at the end of the process, I think you have to say, I lost, but I support the outcome.
Next question.
Yeah.
You made me think about this. As council members, is it correct for us to just prioritize what we consider as our constituents and work for them and not work for the entire town?
It's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. You'll see a slide in a moment that will sort of give you my answer, but this is one of the biggest differences, I think, between national politics, state politics, and local politics. There might be competing claims. There definitely are competing claims, even on the local level. But local politics is so personal. It's so relational. It's so not detached from people's day-to-day lives that I would argue that on a local level, your constituency is all the citizens of the town of Amherst. I don't think that you divide constituencies on the local level the same way you do on a federal level or even on a state level. This is not the battle of the R's versus the D's. You know, one of the best quotes I've repeated a gazillion times, I don't even know where it comes from, is, you know, potholes don't have political parties. 99.99% of what you do, whatever you think about immigration or abortion or the withdrawal from Afghanistan, is 100% irrelevant. So if you're taking marching orders from someone higher up the food chain, I think you're making a huge mistake as a local elected official. And if you're playing favorites with one sub-constituency group within town, because they're your buddies, I think you're showing preferential treatment. Now, that doesn't mean you can't disagree, right? Because you could argue business is a constituency, and we've heard from that constituency that we're difficult to deal with. So we need to loosen that up. But I'm not loosening that up just because I think it's intrinsically valuable to be business-friendly. There's nothing intrinsically valuable about that. It's instrumentally valuable. If I'm business friendly, I can attract the kind of businesses that our citizens want. I can increase our tax base so that I can pay for the kind of education that our kids need. I can make sure there are no potholes in our roads. We can do all sorts of things when we grow the economy. So I'm not growing the economy for the sake of the economy. It's not like business is my constituency. My constituency is the town. To advance the interests of the entire town, I might need to pay attention to what a particular constituency group is saying. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, one more question.
Sure.
As a council member, should I focus more on what I consider my local group that voted for me? Should I focus on how I respond basically solely on that group and not on the town? I'm asking these questions because I've heard council member say, I'm voting in alignment to my constituents. And I'm voting in alignment for the ones that have voted for me. So to me, you're not a council member on behalf of this town. You're owned by a little group. That's how I look at it. And I could be wrong, so I'm asking you.
I would respond to that by saying that your constituency group, the group that votes for you, the group that appreciates what you do and puts you in office for a particular reason, that, look, you did make some promises. You did make some representations about what you intended to do when you were on council. And you need to be consistent with that. So there's nothing wrong with saying, here's an interest group that has an interest that I think is a valid interest, And so I want to communicate that interest to council for all of us to debate about. That's perfectly fine, right? We all have different perspectives. We all have different friendship groups. We all have different, you know, life experiences. So we're all going to see these things differently. So it would be crazy for me to say, you're not allowed to listen to whatever that group is that bends your ear. They're your earbenders. So of course you have to listen to them. But then you also need to be able to say, I need to put that in a bigger context. So how does this actually intersect with the interests of other groups in the city? And if on the whole, I determine that advancing the interests of this group actually is a good thing for the city, I will advance the interests of that group, and I will say, this is the group I'm representing right now. But if I think that little group is actually going to do something harmful to the town, I'm going to have to go back to that group and say, hey, well, you said it, you know, before I got on council, I didn't realize how complex this stuff is. But now that I'm here and I've read all this stuff, guess what? It's not as slam dunk as you think. So let me explain to you why I'm going to do something a little different. I don't think you're owned by anybody. I'm not naive enough to think that no one should influence you. I certainly had influences on me, and I rejected the influence of some and accepted the recommendations or advice of others. That's just being human. But I try always to put that into the structure of council itself. So, skip that. So, if we want to boil this down, we need to recognize the distinct roles of local, state, and national government. And I think this is what we get wrong more often than not. In all the work I've done with local governments, what I have seen is that politics on the national level has gotten ugly. Extraordinarily partisan, based on a few hot button, often culture war type issues. And that is flowing onto the local level. It's infecting every level of politics. I think that's really dangerous on the local level. You don't get to decide whether abortion is legal or not legal in the state. So don't even waste a second's brain power on it. It's outside of your role. It's above your pay scale. It's not your job. No one hired you to do that. And if they thought they hired you to do that, well, then you probably misled them. So recognize the distinct role that you play in local government. I can't stress it enough. Focus on the obligations that attach to those relevant roles. Right? What the President of the United States gets to do is very different than what the mayor of town of Amherst gets to do. Not only gets to do, but should do, right? So maintain focus on the obligations that actually attach to your local role, which means, and now we're getting to a real answer to your question, distinguish between personal values and professional responsibilities.
That's good.
Okay? You've got to recognize that you can believe whatever you want to believe, but you have a professional responsibility to act as a councilman. Okay? I see this in all the fields where I work. Doctors, okay? So you come into my doctor's office, and I don't like you, right? I don't want to be with you. Am I allowed to now say, well, I'm not going to treat people like this? Or do I have to say, personally, I might disagree with your position? You voted in the last election the way I didn't. Okay, actually, the real case, you're gay. And I'm a fundamentalist Christian.
I didn't know that.
Okay? Yes. Now you know. We're going to quote that one in the paper, right?
I've been watching you.
I've actually had doctors or mental health providers say, I don't want to work. I don't want to work with anyone who's gay.
Whoa.
And we've had to say, well, look, if you have a private doctor's office, I suppose you can put up a shingle and say whatever you want to say on it. But you work for a public agency. We don't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. You don't have to like the person. You don't have to agree with the person. You're a doctor, for crying out loud. They have an infection. Write them a prescription for antibiotics. That's the distinction between personal values, which sometimes you have to put in your back pocket in order to satisfy your professional obligation. And then, I would say that you should avoid introducing discussions of issues outside of local jurisdiction, especially when they invoke partisan arguments. It's just none of your business. I'll give you two examples of this. Okay? Example number one, when I was mayor of Lynchburg, I got invited to the governor's mansion for lunch. I thought, wow, well, this is nice. I guess he's inviting all the mayors to come have lunch. Not quite. He collected up a bunch of mayors that he thought were sympathetic. You're about to learn a little bit more, at least about my leanings politically. Because I was invited to the governor's mansion. We had lunch, and over lunch, the governor at the time said, okay, mayors, I want you all to go back to your local councils and get a resolution passed supporting Medicaid expansion. And every mayor around the table so dutifully said, okay, you got it. I'm going back. Give me the text. I'll force a vote. Roanoke was sitting next to me. Charlottesville was sitting next to me. And then it came to my turn. And I said to the governor, no, can't do that. And he looked not happy. And he said, well, what, you don't agree with Medicaid expansion? This is where you get a hint of my politics. I said, no, I think Medicaid expansion is a great idea. I think Virginia should have it. But we're a Dillon rule state. We don't get to chime in on that sort of stuff. We have no jurisdiction over that issue. And my job as mayor of Lynchburg is to go back and keep a team humming. And if I inject this issue into a council meeting, I'm going to split council in half for absolutely no reason, because we have no standing to do anything about it. So if you ask me as a person, do I like Medicaid expansion? Yes. Should we have it? Yes. Want to quote me as an individual human being? I think Medicaid expansion would be a good idea for Virginia. Let's not leave those federal dollars on the table. Let's get it to the people who need it. I will say, yes. If you ask me as a mayor to bring up a resolution to council in support of Medicaid expansion, my answer is no. No. He was not a happy governor. That's a left-leaning issue. You want a right-leaning issue? Same concept, Second Amendment sanctuary cities. Fortunately, I was off council by the time this debacle took place in Lynchburg. But why do you want to rile up the entire community, have everybody come in yelling at each other, split council down the middle, so that you can make a comment on something that, once again, is entirely outside of your jurisdiction and way above your pay grade? Are you actually going to instruct your law enforcement officers not to follow the law? If you don't like the law, lobby Richmond. Call the White House. But I'm not going to split my council. And by the way, with sanctuary cities, this wasn't just a council split. Medicaid expansion would have been a council split. I doubt they would have had a public hearing about passing a resolution on Medicaid expansion. But dang, did they have a public hearing on passing a resolution, a non-binding resolution, about the Second Amendment. Hundreds of people showed up. It was hours of vehement debate, and people were at each other's throats for something we have zero control over. So I would argue, all of the things that I said on the previous slide, recognize your role as being in local government, not federal government, not state government. Now, you have to coordinate with them. It's great. You can have your legislative agenda where you lobby for certain things. But recognize the distinct roles. Focus on the obligations that attach to those roles. Make sure that you have a clear distinction between your personal values and your professional responsibilities. And avoid introducing unnecessary strife, because you want to argue about something that is not part of town council's business.
Our thing we usually come out of here, I say a lot, Sarah laughs at me, we stay in our lane.
Stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yep.
You can ask
Sarah, that's my quote. Stay in your lane.
I think that's absolutely true. That's true on everything I just said about your role as a local, as an elected official. It's also true in your relationship with staff.
Yep. Okay. That's where a lot of our discussion.
That's where it has to come from. If a constituent comes to you and says, I want to complain about, this, Or maybe there was a staff person who was rude to me. You need to fix it, okay? You should not be calling that staff person. You should not be doing the fact finding. You should not be getting involved in personnel issues. What you should do is you should say to that constituent, I will bring it to the attention of our manager, and our manager, who's in charge of all the staff. Manager answers to us. Staff answers to her. She's going to be on top of this. Now, if she does a really good job, if she tells me the story that appeases me, if she takes disciplinary action, if someone did something wrong, whatever, whatever, that's her role as the executive. If she does a lousy job of that, well, we'll fire her and we'll get a new executive. Right? She answers to us. Everybody else answers to her. Well, not everybody else. In Lynchburg, council directly hired the city manager, the city attorney, and the clerk of council. Those were direct reports to council. Everybody else was a report to the city manager, or in your case, the town manager. So I love it. Stay in your lane. And you know what? You and I might agree more than we know about big issues. We might disagree vehemently about those other big issues, but we both agree none of it belongs in a council meeting,
right.
and stay in your lane. Questions, comments, arguments?
I have one question.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, this has been fantastic, very informative. I really am enjoying this. I love what we received today. And my question is, I'm an old guy, I know you didn't know that, but.
You're not much older than I am.
Can we have this videoed so we can study it in the future, these retreats like this? Can we have this videoed so we can study it? Because
watch
no
it again.
Way we can remember everything. But it'd be great to, hey, when something come up, I can, at home, I can play this again and go over it.
Well, I wouldn't mind if you had videoed. I think a voice recording is being made, and I can definitely give you a copy of the PowerPoint, so you'd be able to sort of read along with my slides while you listen to key parts of the transcript.
That'd be great.
But yeah, it's a lot of information, so we need to be able to go back and think about it carefully. We're about ready to take lunch, and when we come back, we are going to do nothing but work on how do you take all this and actually put it on paper to help guide our future actions. Before I do that, before we take our break, because we have about 2 minutes, I just want to share with you one other interesting question that came up. And I don't share this with you because we need to process this. It's actually probably going to be more interesting for staff than it will be for the elected officials. But I want you to see how subtle the difference can be in understanding what our role is. So we're not going to debate this case, but I just want to explain to you why I think this is sort of, it helps illustrate how hard you have to work to really think this through. So here's the story, and it's true. It's a true story, but it's not a local government story. Supervisee A is your go-to employee whom you regard as a friend. She is punctual and outgoing, always on top of her work. Supervisee B is more reserved and doesn't speak up in meetings or volunteer for extra projects, but her work has always been solid and completed on time. Right? So you got A and B. You know of a colleague who will be retiring next year, and you are sure that both A and B will want to apply for that job. You now have a significant project, and you believe that B is best suited to do that particular job. So when you get that task done, B's your person. However, success on that project will clearly create an advantage when it comes to apply for next year's open slot, which is a promotion, and for which you believe A is better suited. How should you assign the current task? Now, we're not going to get into a deep debate about this. I'm using this to illustrate a point. You can't answer this question unless you understand your role. Okay? So, I'll bet you half the people in the room would say, if B is better at doing the task and the task needs to get done, you just give it to B. That's straightforward and obvious. I'll bet you the other half of the room is thinking, but part of my role is not just to get a particular task done today. Part of my role is to encourage, basically groom talent so that they can move up the chain of command and assume more responsibility later. Well, if my job is to have a healthy workforce looking forward, I might take a B-plus job on the current task from person A because it gives them the experience leading a team. It exposes them to another area of town business that maybe they haven't seen before. It helps generate in them a set of skills because next year I know that's the one I want to get that promotion. But there will be others who will say, no. That's not fair. If you think that person B would give you an A job, you should never settle for the B-plus job. You got to give it to the person who can get the job done most. Now, it'll be very interesting to hear because I've heard Kim Payne, over time, assign tasks to staff members with the intent of exposing them. Like, you always worked in planning. You know what? I'm gonna put you on a team that deals with finance for a little bit. Why? Are you going to be the crackerjack finance person and get that job done perfectly? No. But I'm playing the long game. And I think if you gain that exposure and those skills, wow, you'll be a really powerful leader, you know, 5 years from now. So I share this with you because I've used this case study, and I promise you I have split the room, and people get really animated about this. There's a group of people who say, my job is to get the task done the best possible, give it to B. There are other people that say, nope, if you're a leader in an organization, it is perfectly good for you to help groom talent. So give it to A. You can't answer this question unless you understand your job. And frankly, I would say that Sarah's job could be completely different than a department head's job. The department head might say, I got to give it to B because I have my marching orders, I'm supposed to get the task done. Whereas the city manager, the town manager might say, actually, we're about the long term, and so we need to really encourage growth in our staff. Which one's right, which one's wrong?
Well,
I think it's going to depend on how you perceive your role.
I would say that it shouldn't matter, in my opinion. I mean, if you think that B is best for that particular assignment, then B should be your choice regardless. It's the long-term accomplishments of A that makes A suitable for the particular overall
job. But A will never have those accomplishments if you don't give A those opportunities.
So why did you throw the friendship card in there?
Excellent! Oh, beautiful! You caught it! You caught it, didn't you? The scariest part of this slide, and that reinforces what we were talking before about consistency and Habitat for Humanity. The scariest word on this slide is friend.
Yes.
Because that introduces the idea, well, you just like A because your buddy's with A, and A is more outgoing, and you sort of hang out at the water fountain with A. B has a skill set that you don't know because you don't hang out with B. Excellent. The reason that word is there is precisely for someone like you to pick up on it and say, all right, wait a minute, I can understand the debate between short-term get the task done versus long-term generate good talent. I can see that debate. But I'm really worried that preferential treatment's going on here because you went out of your way to say, I regard you as a friend. And that should be irrelevant. Love it. You caught it. Beautiful. Think about it during lunch. Because when we come back, we're going to dig in on work. And the whole question is going to be, how do I perceive my role? And notice what a subtle difference in how you perceive your role can change what you think you ought to do. All right, we're done. We have lunch. It's 12:05. We'll come back at 1:05. We'll give you an hour, and then we'll pick up the work.
And council, I'll just make a note. Normally, when we are in a kind of, you know, break for a meal or whatever, ever, you're not in a meeting, but today you are. So you can talk about whatever you want, and I won't come around and you know, tap you on the shoulder. You're in a meeting. You may discuss freely council business or whatever. So
this was an announced meeting.
It's an announced meeting. So obviously there's no business that's going to, you know, no votes that are going to be taken. But I just wanted to make that clear because normally I'm always saying,
You can't talk about
right
business. All right, but now you can. All right.